I would have done it. I'm actually getting well enough that I can lift a tennis ball. Life is getting better every day. I talked about Mr. Erickson's sermonette. It reminded me that last week we had the split sermon from Royden and Chris, and I thought, I got to be careful not to schedule those two guys on the same day anymore. They threw out so much information in an hour that I didn't know what to do with all of it. They kept us busy writing and thinking and flipping pages and so forth the whole time. It's really good to have quality speaking in the sermonettes and the splits and so forth that is not so common to the church in many places. So I appreciate all the work that gets done in that regard. Of course, it'll have to keep me on my toes as well, huh? That's the way it works. Thank you all for all the work that you do. I forgot to mention that we do have the deacons and elders meeting next week before services, and I will get you further details on that in the next couple of days. All of you did respond to my email inviting you to that meeting, and so we'll do that. And those of you who might arrive early, we will be having a meeting in the back, and I'm not sure exactly where we're going to have it. Last time I told them they could come early, and if they wanted a snack here, we could do that. And then I took them into the meeting and never let them get their snack. So this time we may end up in the kitchen eating. I don't know for sure, eating and talking at the same time. We'll try something. Anyway, we do have a deacons meeting next week before services, and I forgot to mention that during the announcements. If you would turn, please, to Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20, we begin at the beginning in verse 1, and God spoke all these words, saying. So here are God's words quoted from him in giving this instruction to the people of Israel. I am the eternal your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the eternal your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the eternal will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the eternal your God. In it you shall do no work, you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the eternal made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Eternal blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Eternal your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. I guess you could say I have 10 points today. I'm not going to enumerate them again, however, so you don't have to worry about numbering them as I go through. But these are God's words, and this is God's fundamental law in its most concise form in terms of what he gave to mankind. God's most concise form was later modified, in a sense, as Christ was asked about the great commandments, and he, of course, divided these 10 into the two of the great commandment of loving God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind, and then all loving your neighbor as yourself. And so we recognize that these 10 points of the law are elaborations of those two, the first four commandments being how to love God, the next six, being how to love neighbor. I say five because, in a sense, honor your father and mother is very sensitively placed between honoring our spiritual father and then loving our physical neighbor. And that father-mother relationship from the time you're an infant, in a sense, is almost the same as God. They are your creators. They are your providers. You are absolutely dependent upon them. And God, interestingly, placed that commandment between honoring him and loving your neighbor. Of course, it belongs there anyway, in the sense that our closest neighbor is our family. God gave Israel his holy law. Tradition says that law was given at Mount Sinai on Pentecost. We can't absolutely prove that, but there are indications that that is the case, and there are many good reasons to believe that this is true. Chiefly that, perhaps, of the calling of Israel out of Egypt, which clearly later becomes a type of the calling of the church out of the world of sin, or spiritual Egypt. So as God brings Israel out of Egypt and lays out his law before them as a way of life, so he calls the church out of the world and lays his law out before them as a way of life, and adds to it that spirit that is given on the day of Pentecost. Regardless of the factual nature of that, it is certainly timely to focus our attention on God's law as we come to the day of Pentecost, and God interestingly gave us this back-to-back holy day. And so I've chosen to talk about the law a little bit today in preparation for the holy day tomorrow. As we look at the entire history of Israel, and all of mankind for that matter, it is clear that a relationship with the Creator God, and I use the term Creator God intentionally, is based in obedience to God's law. It is based on God's law and man's willingness to obey it. In other words, you cannot have a relationship with God without the law being interposed there. It's impossible to know God or to know how to have a relationship with God or serve God without that law present. And I won't take time, and don't have the time in this sermon, to go back and deal with all of those details from the Garden of Eden forward. But it's clear as you read the scriptures and you read about the people God called and how they responded to God and what God worked out in their lives, that the law is the critical key element of a relationship between God and man. The law is God's formula for successful living, if you will, both physically and spiritually. The law is not just a random list of do's and don'ts. The law is a reflection, actually, of the character and the mind of God. As you read the scriptures, as you read how God applies his law, how God judges according to his law, and how Christ responded to God's law and described his law, and how people like David or Joshua or Moses or any number of individuals, Abraham, that you could point to, recognize that this is a way of life. The law of God is a way of life. It is a way to successful living, living that produces good results. The law is spiritual in that sense. It is spiritual. It flows from God. It flows from God in the same way that he sustains. I say the same way as a analogy perhaps, but the spiritual law flows from God in the same way that the power to sustain the universe, the fact that the earth keeps turning and the sun comes up in the morning, as we say, which is of course not an accurate scientific statement, but the earth turns and we see the sun day by day. We have rainfall most of the time in due season, except in certain parts of Texas. Now God is sustaining the earth, and he can choose to bless it or to withdraw, and he does that, again, often based on his law and man's obedience to it. But God's spiritual law is flowing from him. It comes forward from him at times without limit, as it did to Jesus Christ, at times in apparent portions as he uses it to produce fruits in the lives of individuals, either his prophets for a very specific purpose, such as John the Baptist, let's say, or in us to produce the fruits that Dr. Erickson was describing earlier in the sermonette. Today, I want us to understand that the primary way we can measure our relationship with God, and therefore our Christianity, the way we can measure it is to determine how much we are in tune with or obedient to God's law. And we know more than anybody else. Nobody in this room knows as much about how much you are in tune with God and God's law as you do. Even those of us living together as husband and wife can't be as thoroughly sure of how our relationship is with God or how each other's relationship is as we can with our own. So we measure our relationship with God and therefore our Christianity by our relationship to God's law, how much we are in tune with it, how much we are obedient to it, because that's what God gave us as a measuring stick. It's what God gave us to show us how to live. Now later, that's amplified, of course, in the New Testament, not just these Ten Commandments, but all of Christ's words and Christ's example and Christ's experience modifies that expression to help us understand how to love one another, for example. The law tells us the cardinal points, don't murder, don't steal, don't commit adultery, don't covet, etc. It tells us the cardinal points of how to love one another. But Christ gets into more stories of the kind we heard already, and Christ gets into more examples and more amplification of how you add the spirit and the understanding of the law to the letter of the law which Israel was given. So I would like to make sure today that we understand, and not just today, but every day in the future, I'd like for us to understand the value that we should place on the knowledge and the understanding of God's law. Because believe me, brethren, nobody knows God's law. Nobody understands God's law except God's people. We'll talk about that some tomorrow, but I hope we understand that. The value that we place on God's law is beyond our ability even to chart. And if we don't value God's law that way, then we won't be in harmony with it. We won't be attuned to it. We won't yield to it. We will not surrender our lives into God's hands so that He can motivate and provoke us to live by God's law. The law is given to us as a guide for life. The Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 7, you know the context of the chapter well. Let's go there, Romans chapter 7, and pull this statement out that Paul made that is a nugget, a kernel of truth that adds to what we have already seen and understood through the Old Testament and the letter of the law. We could not necessarily understand this. Well, we can't if I read it out of the book of Acts either. A lot of us keep doing that lately. We're ending up in the wrong books. This Bible has pages about one third as thick as my previous Bible, and I always end up turning too many or not enough. Romans chapter 7. Let's just look first at verse 14, which says, "For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin." Now disregard, in a sense, the context in terms of Paul going on to talk about his own nature, and just look at the fact that it says, the law is spiritual, but I am carnal. There's something very different about God's law. We are human. We are flesh and blood. Carnal just means meat or flesh. We are flesh and blood. We're carnal. We are what we are. We're made of the dust of the ground. But the law is something far greater than that and far more encompassing than that. The law is spiritual. And so we have to look at the law from a spiritual perspective. If we back up a minute now to verse 12, here's another confirming statement. Verse 12. "Therefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy, and just, and good." Now, holy, of course, means that they come from God, that God is in them. And so, once again, they're spiritual. "And just and good," again, are reflections of God's own character and God's own nature and what He intends to do in bringing His creation to fruition, if you will, bringing many sons to glory, bringing children into His family. So the law is spiritual. The law is a large part of what changes us. We'll hear about the Holy Spirit tomorrow, which of course is the other change agent that goes hand in hand with the law. And there are others, but those two primary, the law and the Spirit, are what makes it possible for us as carnal human beings to change to something else and for God to change us. The law is holy, just, and good. So when we go back and look at the book of Exodus, and we go even farther back, let's say, and look at how God dealt with human beings from the beginning, and then we look at how God brought Israel out of Egypt and made them a special people. And again, we'll talk more about that tomorrow, but it is important to understand that when God gave them the law, it was not just sort of, okay, here's what I expect of you, and here's how you have to conduct yourself, some kind of a list of do's and don'ts. It was delivering part of the tree of life into the hands of the Israelites. The tree of life was in the garden, and man was cut off from it, and the tree of life disappeared for all practical purposes. We don't know how long those cherubim and the sword were there and what actually ultimately happened, but man was cut off from it. When God brought Israel out of Egypt and gave them his law, he gave them certain elements that had to be contained in the tree of life once you read all about the tree of life and come to understand it. So he gave them his law, and it's an important gift that God delivered to Israel, and you can see why God was aggravated and frustrated with them when they ignored it, when they rejected it, when they scoffed at it, as they ultimately did. Let's go back to the book of Deuteronomy then, as Israel is coming close to the promised land and Moses is rehearsing for them some of the events in their history. Chapter 27, Deuteronomy 27, verse 8. Let's back up for just a minute, if you will, to verse 1 and 2, just to give you the history here. I jumped into the middle. Now Moses, with the elders of Israel, commanded the people, saying, keep all the commandments which I command you today. Verse 1. And it shall be on the day when you cross over the Jordan to the land which the Eternal your God has given you, that you shall set up for yourselves large stones and whitewash them with lime. You shall write on them all the words of this law. So that's the context. Moses is saying, don't go into the promised land without stopping first and saying, here's the law of God by which we're commanded to live. And write it down. Can you imagine setting up these big stones and whitewashing them and then writing all over them? We call that graffiti today. But in those days, it was their option to historically, if you will, create a memorial of the fact that God gave them his law. So coming down to verse 8, he says, and you shall write very plainly on the stones all the words of this law. Then Moses and the priests, the Levites, spoke to all Israel, saying, take heed and listen, O Israel. This day you have become the people of the Lord your God. This day you have become the people of God. Now, I would have thought that since they had been the people of God all along, when he began to call them out of Egypt and from that first Passover and so forth, then no doubt they were at a certain level. But of course, that generation all died off except for Joshua and Caleb. And this is a whole new generation that's starting into the promised land. And Moses is trying to lay for them the same foundation that that first generation had received at Mount Sinai. And so he says, write it all down and remember that today, as you cross over this Jordan, I think that's the time sequence when he says, take heed and listen, this day, he means as you do what I'm telling you to do, as you go through this ceremony, cross the Jordan, which shows that you are willing to follow God's lead and follow God's command and do what he told you to do, unlike your fathers, which if you read the previous chapters, he's rehearsed as well how rebellious the parents were. He says, cross over the Jordan, write this law on these stones, and you will this day become the people of the Eternal your God. Therefore, you shall obey the voice of the Eternal your God and observe his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today. Now, that section there where it says become the people of God becomes important as we talk about the church as well tomorrow and the birthday of the church, as we call it, on the day of Pentecost. But he's focusing here on their identity coming from their obedience to God's law. Not only their identity, but of course their blessings and their way of life, because again, the law represents a way of life. But he is telling them, this is who you are. Today, you become the people of God. We jump forward to chapter 31. chapter 31. And we have a follow-on command. Verse 9. Deuteronomy 31, verse 9. So Moses wrote this law and delivered it to the priests, the sons of Levi, who bore the ark of the covenant of the eternal, and to the elders of Israel, all the elders of Israel. And Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, at the appointed time in the year of release, at the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel comes to appear before the eternal your God in the place which he chooses, and that day it was the one place where the tabernacle was, when they come to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, and they come before God in the place which he chooses, you shall read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Probably a practice we should still keep today. In one sense we do. We read the law indirectly over an 8-day period by preaching and teaching out of the law repeatedly, but I don't know that we just read through the law. And this, of course, could also refer to the much more complete version of the law, although I believe in this case Moses is referring to the Ten Commandments. You shall read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Gather the people together, men and women, little ones, and the strangers within your gates, that they may hear and they may learn to fear the eternal your God and carefully observe all the words of this law, and that all their children who have not known it may hear and learn to fear the eternal your God as long as you live in the land which you cross the Jordan to possess. So you see, Moses is trying to make sure this generational change and future generations do not forget the law of God. And how many times did God say, if you forget my law, or because you forgot my law, as you read Israel's history? It wasn't because they weren't warned. It wasn't because they weren't told the importance of the law or given the value of the law. They were. They were told that the law is critical to your success. They were told that the law was their identity. They were told that the law was going to provide for them a wide range of benefits. Moving forward to Joshua chapter 8. Joshua chapter 8. Let me see. Let's We're here dealing with Joshua building the altar and preparing to serve God. Joshua 8, verse 30. Now Joshua built an altar to the eternal God of Israel in Mount Ebal, as Moses, the servant of the eternal, had commanded the children of Israel, as is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of whole stones over which no man has wielded an iron tool. And they offered on it burnt offerings to the eternal and sacrificed peace offerings. And there, in the presence of the children of Israel, he wrote on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written. Then all Israel, with their elders and officers and judges, stood on either side of the ark before the priests, the Levites, who bore the ark of the covenant of the eternal, the stranger as well as he was born among them. Half of them were in front of Mount Gerizim, and half of them in front of Mount Ebal, as Moses, the servant of the eternal, had commanded before, that they should bless the people of Israel. Verse 34, and afterward he read all the words of the law. Not only did they write it out, but Joshua then read all the words of the law, the blessings and the cursings. So, see, it was more than just the Ten Commandments. It was also the blessings and the cursings. What happens if you obey God's law? What happens if you don't obey God's law? God did not leave them in the dark. The blessings and the cursings according to all that is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded which Joshua did not read before all the assembly of Israel with the women, the little ones, and the strangers who were living among them. So the law was clearly a huge focal point, wasn't it? God said, write the law, read the law, teach the law, make sure the children and the children's children understand the law after they have come into the promised land. Why was that so important? Well, again, because it was the relationship between them and God. It was the basis of their relationship. All the sacrifices and offerings and all of those things were geared to the law. They were part of the process of recognizing when you failed to keep the law. They were added because of transgressions, it says in Jeremiah. They were there to recognize when we fell short of the law. The law was how to live. The law included the blessings and the cursings, and later on the statutes and judgments, so that God showed us how to apply the law and how to live according to the law. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 28 again, Deuteronomy chapter 28 this time. I don't believe we've been there. Deuteronomy chapter 28. The law is spiritual. The law is a formula for living. And the law is a connection between us and God. It is a relationship with God. You know, when you obey laws or when you obey rules, you acknowledge the authority and the control of those who generate those laws. You and I, recently, most of us, had to fill out tax forms and pay taxes. Because there's a law in place that says you've got to do that. You live in this country, you pay taxes. Of course, there are exemptions and so forth, and some people don't pay any tax. But for the most part, we pay taxes. And when we do so, we acknowledge the government's authority to tax us as a human government. When we drive down the freeway and we decide, are we going to go 65 or 75 or 95, like a couple of guys did today when went by me, which one of you was that? You decide, am I going to keep this law? And of course, man gives some flexibility there. I'm not suggesting that you can't sometimes be 2 or 3 miles over the speed limit or whatever. It's just that the law is there to guide our actions and the traffic, and we recognize that the state or the city or whomever it might be in whatever case has the responsibility and the authority to set those speed limits. They're in authority. That's what obeying the law says. I acknowledge, I recognize their authority. When you obey your parents, children, teenagers, and when those of us who are twice a teenager's age, like some of us are, when you're obeying your parents, why is that? You're acknowledging that they are in authority over your life, that they have the ability to bless or curse you. They have the ability to provide for you. They have the ability to withhold from you, to do things like ground you for a week, or to do things like take away your privileges on the computer, or to do things like take away your pea shooter when you go to school. Think I'm dating myself, don't you? Well, I just finished reading an article that was infuriating. It was called That's Outrageous, I think, one of those articles in Reader's Digest, and the guy was talking about how we have created laws and rules about everything. And see, that's the other problem. Man's authority and people in authority then don't know how to provide law like God provided law. So man makes some good laws, and God tells us we're subject to them, but man makes some laws that are stupid. They're foolish. A student was recently charged for shooting a spit wad and hitting a person in the side of the face or whatever in school. And so he was brought to court, and the defense lawyer said, you know, more or less, kids will be kids. This was not a major act of crime. These kids shouldn't be put in this situation. Now, I'm not giving you the whole story, but the fact is, the prosecutor said, assault is assault is assault. So his position was shooting a spit wad across the classroom was the same as bringing an AK-47 shooting in the classroom. I mean, that's the approach that he took, because man doesn't know how to make laws and make judgments. God does, and God did it perfectly. Deuteronomy 28 verse 1. The law carries blessings and it carries consequences. And I say carries because, in a sense, they are inherent in the process. God can intervene to add or subtract from them, but they are there inherently in the law. Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Eternal your God, to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Eternal your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. Now, this is clearly a miraculous intervention. God is going to give them special attention and special favor in all the earth if they obey his law. But of course, to some degree, they would rise to that level anyway, wouldn't they? Because they're keeping a law that produces the kind of fruit that would make them the greatest nation on the face of the earth. So when you read these things, you have to understand that God incorporated into his law blessings and cursings, and then he reserves the right to intervene and withdraw or add to, depending on your attitude. It's what he did with David. It's what he did with Moses. You know, Moses was tremendously meek man and was obedient to God and served God, and we would call him very righteous, and his name is listed among the righteous later on in the Bible. But Moses was told repeatedly in the last couple of years of his life, you're not going into the promised land because of what you did back there at Meribah and not honoring me before the children of Israel. So God had the right to withhold a certain blessing that Moses might have otherwise expected. God, in deference to Moses' emotional need, let him go up to the top of Mount Nebo and look over and see the promised land. And if you read that carefully, it says he let him see the promised land all the way to Dan and all the way to the Great Sea, which is the Mediterranean. Now, I don't know how many of you have been to Israel or Palestine. Can I see some hands? How many of you have actually been in Israel or Palestine? Not very many of you. Well, those of you who have, or even if you've just studied it on paper, you have to understand that it's a very long way from Mount Nebo on the east side of the Jordan, down below Jericho, to Dan, which is way up north of the Sea of Galilee, and the Mediterranean, clear on the west side of Israel. Oh yes, it's only a few hundred miles, it's a few hours drive, but it says he showed it to Moses, and Moses looked at all the land. How do you do that? He had more than laser surgery, I guarantee you, Doc. Don't get any big ideas. God made it possible for him to see from Mount Nebo all the land of Israel, which goes actually all the way up to basically to Damascus, to the Golan Heights and all of that. Moses couldn't have seen that, but God gave it to him. He revealed it to him in a vision. He allowed him to see something that no other human being could see, and yet he wasn't going to let him go there. Because God has that prerogative to make judgments. What I'm trying to help us understand is that the law is spiritual. It flows from God, and God put within that law blessings and cursings and consequences. He doesn't necessarily have to sit there and pull all the levers every time we sin or every time we do something good. The results will come automatically. We get slapped around for sin, and we get blessed for obedience. But if he chooses to pull a lever, if he chooses to derail the train, if he chooses to pull the switch, things are going to be different. And he can do that. But he built within here these blessings. And of course, the whole chapter is full of blessings and cursings, which I will not try to read all of to you today. But notice verse 2, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you because you obey the voice of the Eternal your God. And he goes on then to outline them, all kinds of blessings of crops, blessings of peace, blessings of healthy children, all kinds of wonderful blessings that Israel is going to receive because they obey his law. And then, of course, later in the chapter, verse 15, but it shall come to pass if you do not obey the voice of the Eternal your God to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. So the way of life is there. And it really, again, is similar to, and I'm not trying to draw a direct analogy here, but it's similar to the Garden of Eden, in which Adam and Eve could have taken of the tree of life and followed God and received all the blessings that flowed from that. Or they could take of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which they did, and receive all the curses that were going to flow from that. Now, God stepped in and defined those curses, and he even told them some specific things that he was imposing upon them. And the rest of it has just all happened as man has sinned and continued to sin and deteriorate down through thousands of years and generations, hundreds of generations. So if you obey my voice, this will happen. If you don't obey my voice, this is going to happen. The law tells us how to live effectively, but the law has built-in consequences, both positive and negative that flow with that law. Obeying God's law leads to a way of life that produces joy, peace, love, happiness, abundance, every good thing that we could want. Now, again, I'm not preaching the health and wealth gospel Royden was talking about last week, which is living for today, thinking if I obey God now, I can have all these things that I want without any understanding of the law and the understanding of the long-term purpose of the law. But I am saying is that God created a law that produces ideal living as he intended it from the beginning. That God allows us to live according to his law, and to the degree that we're able to do that, our lives will be changed and our lives will be better. God still allows us to live in a world that is filled with sin, and we often suffer the consequences of other people's sins as well as our own. And God allows us to suffer sometimes and allows us to develop patience and character and faith in order to prepare us for the kingdom that is to come, so that we can show we're surrendered to him and completely submissive to him. You know, this law, while we're here, it is not about just being able to somehow, as the Pharisees tried to, very carefully and almost microscopically keep every little point of the law. It's about surrendering to God. It's about saying God's in charge. God is in authority. God is my God. God is my ruler. God is my king. God has the power of life and death over me. And I want to do what God wants me to do. And I believe God's way is better than my way. And I want to serve God accordingly. The law is in motion. When we break it, we take ourselves out of that personal relationship with God for the moment. And we lean to our own understanding. We're not surrendering our lives to God in faith that he will provide what we have need of, both physically and spiritually. Let's look at an example. Psalm 119, verse 165. You know this one probably by memory. As Chris mentioned last week, lots of memory scriptures that we've learned by rote. There are others that we've just been over so many times, and they're so focused that we do remember them. And this is one of them, Psalm 119, verse 165. Great peace have those who love your law. I like the King James. Great peace have they that love your law. Great peace have those who love your law, and nothing causes them to stumble. Or King James, nothing shall offend them, as I recall. Great peace have they who love your law, and nothing causes them to stumble. So he's saying if you love the law and you're working to fulfill the law, then you're at peace with God, and basically your life is going to have a level of peace that people without God's law simply won't have. How blessed we are. Again, what is the value of God's law in your life? Proverbs chapter 6, we get another example. Proverbs chapter 6. Here, of course, is, generally speaking, Solomon's counsel as the wisest man who ever lived. Chapter 6, verse 20. Proverbs 6, 20. My son, keep your father's command and do not forsake the law of your mother. Bind them continually upon your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you roam, they will lead you. When you sleep, they will keep you. When you awake, they will speak with you. In other words, the law is a way of life. It is a guide. For the commandment is a lamp and the law a light. Reproofs of instruction are the way of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the flattering tongue of a seductress. And then he goes on into that whole problem of human nature and temptation and the sins that so easily beset man. The law is there as a way of life. It's there to protect and defend you. It's there to keep you out of trouble. It's there to make life good for you. You know, David was a man after God's own heart, and David knew the importance of binding himself to God's law, especially after he had committed terrible sins and made many mistakes and had been directly corrected by God. Let's go back to Psalm 119 again, just a few pages back. Psalm 119. Let's begin here in verse 97. We sing this part of it, verse 97 of Psalm 119. Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. David was a man of many passions. He was a man of a tremendous personality. You know, he got in trouble for dancing as he rejoiced before God after a victory. He got in trouble for winning battles because Saul was jealous. He was brave and forthright and maybe even a bit brash at times. But he was a man after God's own heart, and he wanted to do what was right in God's eyes. And so he said, I love your law. How many times can we say, and do we say, I love your law? We're sometimes fearful of it. We're sometimes thinking, I've heard people say, well, if it weren't for God's law, I would do such and such. What? No, God's law is the way that guides us into a way of life that we could never have any other way. Verse 98, you through your commandments make me wiser than my enemies, for they are ever with me. That is the commandments. I have more understanding than all my teachers, for your testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the ancients because I keep your precepts. So David recognized that his life and his wisdom and his capacity and his ability, his knowledge and understanding came from God, and they came from God's law. They came from God's law working in his life and him yielding to it. Back to our forward to verse 105 here, just a few verses down, 105. Your word is a lamp to my feet. There that is again. We just read that in Proverbs. Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. You don't want to go out in the dark without a lamp or without a light. It's a pretty difficult thing to do. Ask any blind person. It's very difficult to get around when you don't have light and you can't see. The law provides that light. It provides that lamp. Back to verse 72, if you will. The value I asked about earlier, this is still not the value, but it's an interesting statement in man's context of value. Verse 72, the law of your mouth is better to me than thousands of coins of gold and silver. Is that the way we look at the law? You know, there are people today who call themselves Christians who will compromise the law in order to gain gold and silver. What sense does that make? If the law is more valuable than gold and silver, what are you doing? That's like saying, I'll trade you a $10 bill for a piece of paper. A blank piece of paper. Now, you have the value in the law of God. Why would you compromise the law of God or break the law of God in order to gain financially, to gain physical material wealth? He says, your law is better to me than thousands of coins of silver and gold. We need to understand the true value of God's law. Now, we've jumped back and forth in this psalm a bit, but of course we could have spent the whole sermon and maybe three or four sermons in this same chapter, this same Psalm 119, because it's all about God's law. And if you want to study the law, this is a good place to start. Now, Christianity today, so-called, of course, believes that it's no longer a requirement to keep God's law. It's not something God requires of us or places on those who serve him today. Now just stop and think about that a moment in just the context of what we've talked about in this last 30 or 40 minutes. Why would you put yourself in the position of saying, the law is not important anymore? All I have to do is accept Christ. Perhaps accept his sacrifice, but only in word. By declaring that I do. What did Christ say? Did Christ say that's where we are? Well, of course not. Matthew chapter 5 and the Sermon on the Mount. Again, you know the scriptures. 5:17. Matthew 5, verse 17. Jesus said, "Do you think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets?" Now, he's referring to a combination of the books, what's written in his name and by his inspiration. But he's also referring to the law itself. "I came not to destroy the law of the prophets. I didn't come to destroy, but to fulfill." Christ came to show us how to live by the law, how to keep the law, not to remove the law or destroy the law. And of course, in chapter 22, he was asked, which is the great commandment, as I mentioned earlier. Chapter 22, verse 36. The lawyer asks him the question, Matthew 22, verse 36. "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" We would say greatest, I suppose, in our present English. "Which is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Eternal, your God, with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." Now, the man was looking for one of the ten, wasn't he? He was looking for some enumeration of one of the ten that would be the most important. But Jesus lumped them all together because the law is a unit. The law is complete. The law covers all of our needs of loving God and loving our fellow man. And so Jesus said, "You shall love the Lord your God." But before the man could jump to any conclusion and say, okay, I got it, he said in verse 38, "This is the first and great commandment." So this is a great commandment that covers the first four, as we understand. "And the second is like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself." He said the second is like it. So if one of them is great and the other one's like it, they must both be great. "You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." The same law and the prophets we just read about in chapter 5. "On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." So everything that's written in the Old Testament, in that sense, the Old Testament for academic purposes, just divided into the law, the prophets, and the writings, as they're called, the historical things. The law, the prophets, and the writings. He said, all the law and the prophets hang upon these two commandments, love God and love toward neighbor. So when you're reading, as you probably do on a regular basis, your process and progress through the scripture, whether in the Bible reading program, which we produce daily on the web, or whether you're just doing your own, when you're reading, keep that in your head, that everything you're reading about somehow interfaces with the law of God and those two commandments. All the stories you read in ancient Israel have to do with, did people love God or did they love one another? How did they keep the law? How did they keep the commandments? What did they do? How did they prove their relationship with God, as I said to us? How do we measure our Christianity? We measure it by our relationship with God through His law. John confirms that. 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2. We'll read verses 3 to 5. 1 John 2, 3 to 5. Verse 3, "Now by this we know that we know him if we keep his commandments." What we say earlier about a relationship with God is defined by how we serve God through keeping his law. We know that we know him if we keep his commandments. If we don't keep his commandments, we can't be sure at all that we know him. We might have to question whether we do. Which brings us back to that question about how can the law be done away. Verse 4, "He who says, 'I know him,' and does not keep his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him." Now please, I understand that there are many well-meaning people who strive to be religious, who go to church, who try to do what they think is obey God. They don't really use the word most of the time, but they mean they want to worship God. They want to be godly. They want to be of God. This does not mean that they are knowingly putting up a front and saying, I'm religious, when in fact they're not keeping the law. They're deceived into believing they don't have to keep the law, so they can be religious without that. They can be righteous without that. But that's not what Christ said. He says, I know him and does not keep his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. That's the fundamental reality, not necessarily the person's intent or understanding. The reality is he doesn't know that he doesn't know. Contrast that to verse 5, but whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. By this we know that we are in him. So keeping his word allows us to love God and love neighbor, and by that we know that we are in him, because we know we can't do it by ourselves. I don't know if I pray this every day, but I probably pray at least 5 times a week in my morning prayers to God. God, I know that I can't do anything by myself. I cannot. Christ said he couldn't. I can't do anything. I can't be righteous. I can't understand. I can't know. I can't do anything without your help. We've got to acknowledge that, brethren, on a regular basis. And if we don't, we're not going to be able to keep God's commandments, because we can't do it of them by ourselves. Let's go back to the Gospel of John, chapter 14, where we, in a sense, find the clincher and the summary, and I'll close with this. John chapter 14. John 14, verse 15. It's all about love today. But of course, it's always been all about love. Love toward God and love toward neighbor. But love is tossed around lightly and is just sort of a mushy, sticky feeling that we might have for people, and that justifies living without the law. But no, that doesn't work. That's not the way it is, because the law tells us, as we just read from Christ's own words, how to love God and how to love your neighbor as yourself. If you love me, keep my commandments. If you love me, keep my commandments. It's pretty simple. We prove our love to God, we prove our submission to God, our worship, our service, our surrender to God by keeping his law. It isn't something we can compromise, beat around the bush about, hide behind. It has to be done. And that's only the starting place, in one sense, as we come to understand spiritually. But he said, if you love me, keep my commandments. Verse 23, same chapter, 14:23. Jesus answered and said to him, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him. And we will come to him and make our home with him. He who does not love me does not keep my words. And the word which you hear is not mine, but the Father's who sent me. So as we come before God tomorrow on his annual holy day of Pentecost, let's remember that Israel received the law in the clearest terms. Israel agreed to keep it, but they did not, indeed they could not, keep the law of God, because they did not have God's Spirit, and the law was not mixed with faith in those that heard it, as the Apostle Paul puts it. Because the law, holy and just and good, still represented only a portion of whatever elements were embodied in the tree of life, which would have given man what he needed to be in unity with God and to serve God and to obey God. That's only part of it. The law is a tremendous part, but it isn't the complete picture. God placed the tree of life in the Garden of Eden to guide man's life. And we know from history and from God's law and from Christ's life, we know from Christ's instruction in the New Testament that it takes more than the law to live the way God intended that we live. Mankind still needs the Holy Spirit. Even with the law of God, he needs the Holy Spirit. You look at those men in the Old Testament who served God and kept his law and obeyed him and were counted worthy and are listed in Hebrews 11. They had to have the Holy Spirit. God gave them what they needed to serve him. The Holy Spirit was poured out on the church at the day of Pentecost. Tomorrow is the day of Pentecost. See you there.